Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be discussing the spread of Christianity. We haven't really talked about how this group became the world's largest religion, and the rise of Christianity is something I remember from being a Christian that I would fall back on. In response to arguments like the ones we've talked about the last few episodes, Christians always have this safety net. Wasn't Christianity's meteoric rise and growth rate and current domination at least some evidence in support of it? Before we talk about the material, historical causes behind the rise of Christianity, we should examine whether this reasoning is valid to begin with. Christians claim that the rise of Christianity was so unusual as to suggest it was divine. And of course, it was unusual. A small forbidden cult spread across the West despite early persecution and went on to become the world's largest religion. We shouldn't undersell the spread of Christianity. This is as strange as a cult with 24 people gaining millions of followers in a few centuries. The situation we're currently living in would be just as strange as traveling a few hundred years into the future and discovering that the Branch Davidians had hundreds of millions of followers. Logically, the idea that the number of people who hold a belief matters at all when determining whether or not that belief is true is obviously wrong. And of course, every religion with a significant following once started as a small group and had a meteoric rise from a few to millions. No religion began with 100 million followers. No matter which religion you belong to, you have to concede that numbers in and of themselves can't be evidence of truth. What about all the places that have never even heard of Christianity and haven't had the chance to accept or reject it? Why has this progression been so inefficient if it's guided by divine power? Christianity is not even close to being the majority, and especially not when you consider that the roughly 30% we're calling Christianity is not a cohesive 30%. I don't see any conflict between naturalism and the fact that all the different versions of Christianity combine to make up less than one-third of the world's religions. I don't even think that fact is more likely on Christianity than on naturalism. If there was an omnipotent God trying to spread Christianity, wouldn't you expect them to be a little more successful and a little more on the same page? The Mormons and the Russian Orthodox can't both be right, and neither can the Lutherans and the Anabaptists. Many distinct faiths that fall under the umbrella of Christianity in that one-third figure are mutually exclusive. If God were invested in this particular religion, you'd think he'd want to make it clear what he wanted. He could ensure that false branches of Christianity wouldn't spring up, or entire false religions, and he would have every interest in doing so. Is he unable to prevent false religions from arising and deceiving us, or is he unwilling for whatever reason? Whatever denomination of Christianity you happen to belong to, if you think that your specific branch is the only way, then you have to reduce the already modest not quite one-third to whatever your particular broad denomination is, and then you have to cut out all the believers in your own denomination who you believe to be insincere or differ in non-trivial ways. At the end of the day, no matter which version of Christianity you adhere to, you should expect to get the wrong answer just as a matter of probability. The majority of people are going to be wrong, and the odds are always that you're in the majority. If every non-Christian is wrong and every version of Christianity except yours is wrong, then no matter what your belief is, 90% of the human population conservatively doesn't believe the truth and is hopelessly doomed. Wasn't the original point of this apologetic to try to appeal to the stunning takeover of the one true religion? If 95% of everyone is wrong, according to you, you shouldn't really be bringing up your religion's rate of success. All these facts fit better in a naturalistic model than a Christian model of the world. The most reasonable form of this argument from apologists is that the success of Christianity and the rate of growth of Christianity is more likely on Christianity than on naturalism. But I'm saying that even the weak, evidential form of the argument doesn't hold water. Yes, you certainly would expect God's favored religion to be the most popular, but the one-third of people who are Christian don't agree on important parts of the story. When you break down the category of Christian into its irreconcilable denominations, you don't end up with a third, or a fourth, or a tenth of the human population. You end up with dozens and dozens of mutually exclusive religions that center loosely around similar themes. This makes perfect sense on naturalism. You wouldn't expect uniformity on naturalism. You'd expect religions to evolve separately and to differ from other groups who were even slightly separated because they're not touching on anything real. If God was guiding Christianity, if there was a top-down organizing force, you wouldn't expect so many irreconcilable versions to spring up. The majority of the living human population is not Christian, but the overwhelming majority of all the humans who have ever existed weren't Christians and didn't know about Christianity. There have been about 100 billion anatomically modern humans that have lived since we showed up 50,000 years ago. So that means that over 90% never heard about Christianity. Wouldn't God make himself known and spread Christianity at the beginning of humanity's existence, not what is probably closer to the end? Why wouldn't everybody hear what God needed to say, including our very similar ancestors and cousins, who presumably were also made in the image of God? What about the at least 5 other now extinct species in the Homo genus who lived long before we did and even coexisted with us? Anatomically modern humans have lived for approximately 50,000 years, but our species, Homo sapiens, has been around for nearly 300,000 years. This is a serious question that any theist has to answer. What took God so long? If starting his religion was the plan all along, why did he watch humanity struggle for so long before doing it?
There is a difference of opinion about how long our species in general has been on the planet. Richard Dawkins thinks it might be as long as 250,000 years. Look, you make it 250,000. I'll take 100. Never mind. I don't need 250,000 for my point. Make it 100,000. 100,000 years, people have been, our species have been around on this spec. Born, usually dying, actually a great number of them in childbirth, wouldn't have got beyond being born. For the first 80 or so, 90 or so thousand years, nearly 100, not living more than 25 to 30 years at the most, then probably dying of their teeth, if they were lucky. Terrible disease, suffering, misery, malnutrition, and fear. Where do the earthquakes come from? Why is there an eclipse? What are the shooting stars doing? And awful cults of sacrifice to try and ward off what are in fact natural events. And war, and rape, and the kidnap of other peoples, and the enslavement of them. All of this goes on. Terrible struggle, sacrifice, pain, misery, and above all, fear and ignorance. And you have to believe this if you believe in monotheism. For the first 97,000, 98,000 of this, heaven watches with indifference. Oh, there they go again. They've all, this, that whole civilization's just died out. Well, what are you going to do? They're raping each other again. They're poisoning they think that the other tribe has poisoned the well, so they're going to kill all their children. All this, just watch all that. 3,000 years ago at the most, it's decided, no, we've got to intervene now. You have to believe it.
As we talk about the material causes of the rise of Christianity, all the historical information I'm about to reference, documents, notable figures, etc., are all coming from The Triumph of Christianity, written by the agnostic historian Bart Ehrman, who you've no doubt heard me reference a million times in the last month. It's linked in the show notes, and I'll be returning to it frequently from here on out. So the Roman Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity in 312 CE. This was an important event, but not quite in the way commonly believed. He did not, for example, make Christianity the official state religion. He legalized Christianity after it had been declared an illicit religion for a short time. Under Constantine, Christianity became legal and even privileged after his conversion, but it wasn't until 80 years later Theodosius I made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire and made paganism illegal. So Constantine was the first Christian emperor and he legalized Christianity, and Theodosius I made Christianity the state religion and persecuted pagans into oblivion. The rate of growth for Christianity was such that if it wasn't Constantine, it would have been someone else. It's not as if his conversion was the make-or-break moment for Christianity as it's often portrayed to be. By the time he converted, Christianity had already grown to a few million followers, nearly 10% of the Roman population. In the United States, we very nearly had a Mormon president, and Mormons make up about 2% of the US population. So at this point, it's not all that weird. A small religion has become a bigger religion. But the location here is highly relevant. Christianity was very much in the right place at the right time. There weren't millions of Christians just anywhere, they were in the Roman Empire. At the time, the biggest and most dominant civilization, and though it eventually fell, it was a major ancestor to modern Western civilization. But Constantine's conversion came almost 300 years after Christianity began, so how did we get to this point? About half the Roman Empire was Christian by the 5th century, putting that number at about 30 million. And no massive conversions were needed for these numbers to be achieved. All you need to witness the amount of growth Christianity had undergone from 30 CE to the 5th century is a growth rate of roughly 3% per year, 30% per decade. If that sounds kind of underwhelming, that's because an exponential curve yields far greater numbers than our intuitions would lead us to believe. It wouldn't even require a concerted evangelistic effort to achieve that rate. And it's not an implausible or miraculous rate of growth. You would just need to occasionally convert a friend or neighbor. We should also keep in mind that the social landscape looked a bit different in that culture. If the head of a household converted, his wife and children also converted. So if you convinced one guy, you gained his whole family as well. The character of Christian doctrine probably did a lot to naturally push adherence towards evangelism. Every early Christian believed that the end of history was right around the corner. They thought God was going to judge the world, and the only ones who would be spared would be Christians. Non-Christians were not going to be annihilated in the destruction of the world. They were going to be tortured for all eternity in hell. If you cared about your friends and neighbors, you would want to tell them. Christianity had a couple of unique characteristics that helped it gain masses of new followers in its context, and one of them was the emphasis on monotheism. The pagans of ancient Rome were polytheists. They believed in and worshipped multiple gods. And according to Christians, your pagan gods were either not real or they were demonic beings deceiving you. Paganism is a bit of a suitcase term that we now use to denote anyone who wasn't Christian or Jewish, but they all did have some things in common. When pagans found a new god to worship, they just added that new god to their list. There was no pressure to become a monotheist or even a henotheist, which is someone who believes in many gods but only worships one. Christian belief is different, and this difference may have conferred a survival advantage to Christianity. When you become a Christian, you had to worship one God and only believe in one God. That meant that once you converted, there was no room for anything that wasn't Christian. Pagan systems of belief could absorb any new gods and survived in part because of that flexibility. Christianity, on the other hand, created a zero-sum conflict and tried to win it. So, the nature of Christianity created a zero-sum contest between it and other religions, and the paganism of the Roman Empire was ill-prepared for this conflict. It didn't really have the theological antibodies to defend against the kinds of challenges Christianity presented. When a pagan was convinced that they should worship a different pagan god, that didn't mean that all the other gods they had been worshiping had to be abandoned, or all the practices they had been engaging in had to cease immediately for the safety of their immortal soul. But if you became convinced by the evangelists for Christianity, or your husband did, the beliefs you had held to before now had one less adherent. Christianity, unlike paganism, was exclusive. So it's kind of a high-risk, high-reward sort of strategy. You can't be incorporated into the pagan pantheon of gods, so if you lose, you really lose. But if you win, you really win. Bart Ehrman writes, quote, "Christianity was the only evangelistic religion that we know of in antiquity. And along with Judaism, it was also the only one that was exclusive. That combination of evangelism and exclusivity proved to be decisive for the triumph of Christianity. If it had been evangelistic but not exclusive, it may have gained adherence, but paganism would have remained unaffected. Pagans would simply have begun to worship Christ along with whatever gods they chose. If, on the other hand, it had been exclusive but not evangelistic, Christianity, like Judaism, would have simply been an isolated and marginal religion without masses of adherents. But it gained a massive following, not at first, but over time, progressively adding to its ranks year after year, decade after decade. As it grew, paganism necessarily shrank." End quote. So the nature of Christianity gave it advantages in the competition for religious dominance. And it should go without saying that these things were the result of their theological beliefs, not some consciously held strategy. What Christians consciously thought of themselves was quite different.
Widespread throughout the ancient world was an ideology of dominance. The idea is that the powerful are supposed to dominate the weak. And so that's why there is no ethical problem with a stronger nation, a stronger empire, destroying another empire and literally killing off people and enslaving those who are left. Because it's all about the stronger dominating the weaker. That's why it's fine to have slavery. Masters are to dominate their slaves. Men are to dominate their women. And this was the widespread ideology on every level. Christianity had a different ideology. Christianity had an ideology of love. Now, I'm not saying that all Christians were loving or that Christians didn't believe in domination, because a lot of Christians certainly did. But at least what they preached from the pulpit was that the poor and the outcast and the oppressed are to be cared for by society.
And of course, Christians remain to this very day the biggest supporters of welfare and helping the poor. Despite the social Darwinism that modern Christians seem to hold to, Jesus preached compassion for the poor. The historical Jesus really did talk about love and helping the most vulnerable quite a lot. I mean, he also thought the end was nigh, and he was, as No Illusions put it, a homeless, ranting, angry communist whose family thought he was crazy. But a part of his message was to love your neighbor as yourself. What the early Christians believed was notably different than what pagans believed, and it was more attractive in a lot of ways. Though it sounds like it wasn't terribly hard to outcompete the Romans on the compassion front, to whatever extent it was emphasized, emphasizing compassion would have provided a selective advantage for Christianity. But don't be misled to think that Christians were just hippies endlessly preaching love. They obviously weren't preaching tolerance, as we already discussed. Their intolerance actually benefited them greatly. The pagans of that day didn't believe in anything like the Christian afterlife. They didn't believe in a heaven or a hell. We write rest in peace on gravestones, and the Romans had their own common epitaph that had a much more Epicurean view of death. Its letters stood for, I was not, I was, I am not, I care not. Epicurus was a Greek philosopher who argued that it was impossible to experience death, since one has to exist to experience anything at all. He said, why should I fear death? If I am, then death is not. If death is, then I am not. Why should I fear that which can only exist if I do not? And this appeared to be the dominant view. Christians came along and eventually started saying something different. You're never gonna die. You'll get to live forever in paradise if you convert. Also, if you don't convert, you'll still live forever, you'll just be burning in hell. Christians focused on some other, unseen world and claimed that this was the true world. It's an easy answer for someone trying to understand the ambiguity, suffering, and injustice that everyone can clearly see. And this was a new idea at the time. At least when you hear it at first, somebody telling you that you don't have to deal with loss is a welcome message. You'll see your loved ones again, and all those people you hate will go to hell. Even the other Christians you don't like will probably go to hell, since they're not Christianing right. So you have heaven for you and your friends and family, and you have hell for your enemies. Bart Ehrman writes, quote, "In the 2nd century, accounts of the afterlife began to appear in Christian texts, often presented as guided tours of the realms of the blessed and the damned. In these, a saint is shown the ecstasies of the saved, and especially, the torments of the lost, presented with barely concealed voyeuristic glee." The Roman historian Ramsay MacMillan has called these accounts, quote, "the only sadistic literature I am aware of in the ancient world," end quote. In a text called The Apocalypse of Peter, Jesus shows the disciple Peter the terrors of hell. Blasphemers are hanged by their tongues, adulterers are suspended by their genitals, women who performed abortions on themselves are buried in excrement up to their necks, idol worshippers are recurringly chased off cliffs, and slaves who disobeyed their masters have to chew out their own tongues. The 3rd century Christian apologist Tertullian said, quote, "What sight shall wake my wonder? What my laughter, my joy and exultation? The magistrates who persecuted the name of Jesus, liquefying in fiercer flames than they kindled in their rage against Christians. Those sages, too, the philosophers, blushing before their disciples as they blaze together." End loving Christian quote. A pagan intellectual named Celsus wrote that Christians proselytized successfully because they, quote, "invent a number of terrifying incentives. Above all, they have concocted a doctrine of everlasting punishments and rewards, exceeding anything the philosophers could have imagined." Saint Augustine himself said, quote, "Very rarely, no, never, does it happen that someone comes to us with the wish to become a Christian who has not been struck by some fear of God." This was a central argument Christians used. They terrified and threatened people with hell. To quote Ehrman one more time, "sophisticated argument was almost certainly not the principal engine of conversion. In addition to appealing to fear, they used arguments appealing to martyrdom, which we talked about last week, and arguments appealing to miracles, which we talked about in the Easter episode, and back in episode 12. We have a few sources that indicate that the early Christians were not the best and brightest in society. In 1 Corinthians 1:26-27, Paul recognizes the status of most of the believers in the church when he says, quote, "Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many of you were powerful, not many of you were born to nobility, But God chose the foolish in the world to put to shame the wise. God chose the weak in the world to put to shame the strong. End quote. He's acknowledging that most of the Christians he's writing to are uneducated and powerless. About a century after Paul wrote that letter, Celsus, the pagan intellectual, made the same observation when he called Christians illiterate and gullible. No serious intellectuals converted to Christianity until centuries after it began. There were three notable figures who converted around the middle of the second century, but those were the earliest ones, and it took centuries longer for Christianity to gain traction with educated people. An early 4th century source, written by a Christian defending Christianity, also indicates that most believers were uneducated and, quote, foolish. I only bring all this up to point out that the evidence, whatever it was only convincing the least skeptical and least educated people for centuries. Christianity was different enough to have a competitive edge over its pagan contemporaries. The combination of evangelism, exclusivity, and belief in the afterlife created a religion that, in the context of the Roman Empire, propagated very successfully. There is actually not a single thing about the spread of Christianity that can't be explained naturalistically with ease once you look at the data. The current number of Christians and the growth of the early church, the two most cited facts in this argument, don't work as objections to naturalism in the slightest. A growth rate of roughly 3% per year is not so miraculous as to defy rational explanation. And less than 1/3 of the human population is not stunning. I don't think we should even consider this 1/3 to be a figure that Christians should be allowed to point to, since it includes believers and entire denominations that others consider to be heretical. Unless you think everybody is going to heaven, all the disparate versions of Catholicism and Protestantism, along with the different versions of the Eastern Orthodox Church and all the LDS Christians, unless you think everyone is right, you can't cite that 1/3 figure. We also shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the popularity of a belief doesn't add to the likelihood of that belief, and yet that's essentially what this apologetic boils down to. Supernatural explanations can be made because they can always be made anywhere, but they're not needed for the spread of Christianity any more than we need a supernatural explanation for volcanic eruptions. Not to mention the endless problems that any invocation of divine intervention raises. What took God so long to do this? Why wasn't an omnipotent being more successful in achieving his goals? Why are there false religions? Why don't Christians agree on anything? You wouldn't expect any of this if Christians were actually right. An omnipotent God, organizing from the top down, easily could have started Christianity the moment humanity came into existence, instead of tens or hundreds of thousands of years after. He could have miraculously spread the gospel to every place on earth, but he didn't for some reason. He could continually prove to us which religion he favors and which ones are untrue. And he could ensure uniformity in the Christian doctrine on the non-trivial matters, so no one could use the true religion to spread falsehoods. But apparently God only intervened enough for a miraculous 3% annual growth rate that resulted in a not quite 1/3 of the population that disagrees with itself to the point of fighting wars over their differences. That's all I have for you today. I primarily used as a source for this episode Bart Ehrman's new book, The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World. I have a couple new patrons to thank, Robert Trout. Thank you, Robert. And I also need to add a patron to the illustrious Patron Hall of Fame. So thank you to my Hall of Fame patrons, Peach Machine and Jesta. Welcome to the Patron Hall of Fame, Jesta. And you can support this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode and access to bonus episodes. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want to hurt Jesus' feelings, you can like us on our social media, leave a 5-star review, or tell your friends about the podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.